Hi, I'm Terry Meekin. Welcome to Roving Report. I went off to see Peter Whitten, poet extraordinaire, whose wry observations on life have entertained many an audience, while his written work has entered the world of some significant anthologies. I asked Peter, first of all, what the market was for poetry and what sort of audience could he expect nowadays.
Generally speaking, it's other poets, although you do get cross-feed with the general public, but if you go to most poetry events around here, you'll probably find quite a lot of poets in the audience.
So is that critics or is that...
no, they're, it's just a matter of what they like to do. Poets seem to like to gather together and do things on the basis of, well, you've had your go, it's my turn next.
So it's a bit like the old folk clubs used to be, to
I
some
would
extent.
Have said so, to
yeah. So when did you get into it in a more intense way, shall we say, rather than in a cursory way?
I have been writing poetry since I was a child. It's the only art form I have. I can't draw to save me life. My singing's nothing to write home about. But poetry seems to have come naturally.
Any published works?
Fair amount. I've published 7 or 8small collections, slim volumes.
A pamphlet, as they used to say in the last century. I have here a pamphlet.
But on the other hand, I do get into quite good quality anthologies, like the Oxford University Press Book of War Poetry.
Is that why you adopted the name Whitten? Because that's a pseudonym, isn't it?
That's right.
Yes. Well, why a pseudonym? Why not under your real name?
When I started submitting poetry for publication, I was still a member of the Royal Air Force. Servicemen are generally not encouraged to write for things that go outside service publications, shall we say. So rather than ask the question, do you mind if I do
this
and get turned down, I thought I wouldn't tell them anyway and just got on with it. And they didn't seem to mind one way or the other. So
Now, is there a particular field of interest with poetry? Because a lot of poets tend to focus themselves in a specific direction.
Not in particularly. As far as I'm concerned, more or less any subject I come across, if it's suitable to be made a poem out of, I will do it, whether it's about sport, about history, contemporary, my children, and now my grandchildren, and other people's children. I cast my net as wide as I can. I have made several poems out of obituaries in the Daily Telegraph, that when you've taken an interest in somebody and you suddenly realise that he'd done an awful lot more things than you thought he had.
Now, tell me the difference between traditional poetry and slam poetry.
If you can imagine a knockout football competition with 16 teams in it, except in this case there's individuals.
Okay.
So you have 16 poets. They are drawn out of a hat into 4 groups of 4. Each poet approaches the microphone again by draw and does his poem, which is normally 3 minutes, is a fairly standard thing, although you can do a couple of poems in that time if you like. And so all 4 poets in that heat do their bit, and then there is a judging process.
What, the other poets?
There are separate judges, usually drawn from the audience, actual fact, with slam poetry. And they will have their say, and whoever gets the highest score progresses to the semi-finals. And so from 16 poets, ideally, you will end up with 4 poets, 1 from each heat, in the semi-final.
So it's a competition. That's where the slam refers to. Not the fastness of it, or the speed of it, or the heaviness of the poem. It's just the slam is the chamber. It's a knockout competition.
It is. And of course, you've got to do a different poem in the semi-final. And should the process be repeated and you wind up in the final, you need another poem for that.
Yesterday I heard you do a poem which would have been a candidate for slam poetry, and it was The History of the World in 3 Minutes. Starting from now, can we have a go at that one?
Certainly. Precambrian, Paleozoic, Mesozoic eras encompassing literally billions of years, enlivened by daily volcanoes, earthquakes colliding and separating tectonic plates, nitrogen and methane belching from all parts of the globe like intercontinental ballistic farts. Gradual evolution of organisms, algae, bacteria, fungi and fish developing into dinosaurs of the Cretaceous and Jurassic periods, voracious beasts who ate either each other or indigestible grasses, accounting for their noxious and exceedingly megasaur arses, which probably led to their extinction if they weren't wiped out pre-our age by a meteor in the first recorded instance of galactic road rage. Following which, both polar ice caps, in a series of unprecedented cold snaps, attempted to meet one another at the equator, but couldn't quite manage it, and sometime later, once they had melted, Homo sapiens, happiens. Then we arrive at the Stone Age, the Bone Age, the indescribably ugly Crone Age, and the breed of a cave dweller who covered his walls in portraits of nomads with hideously exaggerated gonads, which archaeologists would have us believe indicates a mass yomp to anywhere there wasn't a fetid equatorial swamp. Farming was undertaken, entire cities sprang up, temples celebrated Herculean labours, entire civilizations slaughtered their neighbours to fulfil prophecies uttered by Delphic oracles, whilst hereabouts folk in coracles fished peacefully, lived their lives in no particular hurry, did a little light sun worshipping at Glastonbury, and longed for the day when some enterprising farmer would be capable of organising a semi-decent alternative culture festival. But in the meantime there were Vikings, Romans, Angles and Saxons to be assimilated, each with their newfangled language, though they all had the same basic message, to wit, if you don't want this sword shoving up your back passage, give me your land, your livestock, your money, your wife, and I might just permit you to continue your appallingly poverty-stricken life, P.S. Welcome to the feudal system, the Middle Ages, forward knuckling in the presence of barons on minimum wages, the sole alternative to which is outlawry, bog-trotting and being chased from butthole to breakfast by the Sheriff of Nottingham. Thus, in this green and peasant land was invented democracy, which stupid foreigners sometimes got mixed up with autocracy, particularly when we began to play away matches, winning with ease at Cressy, Agincourt, Ramillies, Trafalgar, Blenheim, Aboukir, and all stations to Waterloo, change here for the Hanover line, calling it George the Fat, George the Fatter, George the Mad as a completely mad hatter, terminating in Victoria. Following whose death the heady euphoria of world domination appeared to become boring, we lost all our colonies, stopped scoring at football and cricket, but while the rest of the country turned into couch potatoes watching neighbours and home and away, here in Gloucestershire, folk still turn out for good grammatical poetry, like what we have heard today.
Melvin Bragg, eat your heart out. A little while ago I was in Canada and I did a programme on the Titanic, in fact meeting the last living relative of somebody who went down on the Titanic. And I believe you've got something to offer in that respect as well.
Oh, yes. It concerns, of course, the band and what the band on the Titanic played when the ship went down. And it's called Total Recall. They played, as good musicians always should, wherever they could find an audience. A deck, to start with, in the first-class lounge. Afterwards, grand staircase, boat deck level. Lastly, the stricken liner's tilting deck, as lifeboat after lifeboat crawled away like beetles across stark Atlantic swell. A literally gallant band of men, not one of whom survived the night to turn this unique booking to career advantage. The subsequent inquiry brought to light a curious diversity in people's recollections of the melodies performed. Nearer, my God, to thee, several recalled, mood music to the ears of journalists much more concerned with hype than common sense. These troopers plied their trade to boost morale, not reconcile souls to an early grave. Other survivors spoke of current hits from London or New York like In the Shadows, Alexander's Ragtime Band, and haunting Song d'Automne, plausible contender for the somewhat dubious accolade of what the band was playing when the ship went down.
So, if you had to pick a poem of all the ones that you've written, which are the one you think you might be the proudest of?
I'm fondest of one about charity shops. Although I have written many better poems, like the one that's in that anthology, the one that seems to get asked for most is The Ladies of the Charity Shop. The ladies of the charity shop were given a brand new till. They never got the hang of it. and now they never will. They only approached it in groups of three with expressions of loathing and pain, one to push buttons, one to have kittens, and one to try it again. The ladies of the charity shop were a most harmonious clique. They all popped in on a rotative basis at least three mornings a week to drink gallons and gallons and gallons of tea and have a good chinwag about cardigans, ornaments, wrestling tournaments, gallbladders, goiters and gout. The ladies of the charity shop maintained with no hint of apology that they never expected to find themselves at the forefront of till technology. The old model suited them down to the ground. When they wanted to put in some cash and the drawer got jammed, they bothered and damned and gave it a good old bash. The ladies of the charity shop have been in darkest mourning since 9:45 last Wednesday when, without the slightest warning, as they opened the new till to put in a pound, the contraption showed its teeth, gave a frightful roar like a carnivore, and swallowed Jemima Moncrief. The ladies of the charity shop phoned divisional headquarters. No repairman came, but a TV crew and a posse of press reporters. One asked the ladies a question, with a tabloid glint in his eye. Was the victim nude? They said, "Don't be rude, this isn't the WI." The ladies of the charity shop have sold off all their stock to a nice young man with a transit van and a stall on Camden Lock. At their manager's suggestion, they all went on the spree, got merry on sherry on the Brittany Ferry, and buried the till at sea.
Well done, well done. So the ladies of the charity shop is the one you get asked for the most. What would you feel the one you're proudest of the most?
Well, that would be a poem called Unmentioned in Dispatches, which has got into the Oxford University Press Book of War Poetry.
And when did you write this?
Oh, several years ago, following First Gulf War.
Right, you're still in the service then, were you?
I was, indeed.
Okay, let's hear that then.
Unmentioned in Dispatches. Some of them never come home to fanfares. They dump their kit bags down at the door, kiss their wives and let their children wrestle them down to the kitchen floor, switch the telly on, pour out a whiskey, search for the local football score. Some of them skip the quayside welcome, dodge the bunting and cannonade, make their landfall in silent harbours, nod to the coast guard, but evade the searchlight of public scrutiny, like those engaged in the smuggling trade. Some of them land at lonely airfields, far removed from the celebration, hang their flying gear in a locker, cadge a lift to the railway station, make for home and take for granted the short-lived thanks of a grateful nation. Some of them miss the royal salute, the victory parade along the moor, the flypast, the ships in formation passing the cheering crowds on the harbour wall, remembered only by friends and relatives. Some of them never come home at all.
Excellent. Very poignant. On a first hearing of your voice, I can almost hear an Adam Bennett tinge in there somewhere along the line. I could imagine some of his stuff would be meat and drink to you.
Well, I enjoyed recently voicing Laurie Lee, and the BBC Radio Gloucestershire did a programme on his trip to the Civil War in Spain.
When you were actually in the RAF, I mean, were you in the academic side, in the teaching side? Did you drop bombs?
No, I was air crew on the Nimrod aircraft.
There is such a thing as the Football Poets Society. As you were wearing the shirt yesterday, the number 9 shirt, perhaps you could score by giving us a sample of a football poem.
Well, how about this one, which stemmed from a CFAX headline? Socrates selected by non-league outfit. The Brazilian legendary football captain, Socrates, apparently came to England in the 1990s, I believe, at the age of 50-odd, and I have no idea why, signed up for a month for Garforth Town, who play in one of the northeastern minor leagues. And he took part in a match against Tadcaster, Albion, and it was a 2-2 draw, November 2004, according to my records. But as soon as I saw this sign on the radio, Socrates selected by non-league outfit, That portion of classical education that I have, which is not great, started wondering what other immortals could possibly have played football.
And where did that train of thought take you?
It took me to Immortals United team sheet. First off, I was thinking Achilles to lead the line. He's got the aggression, but he's injury prone and the guy is so slow he couldn't catch a tortoise. So I've gone for Isaac Newton, who at least knows how to head a ball. Also good in the air are Icarus and the Archangel Gabriel, though Icarus tends to fall away in the second half if the going gets hot. In central midfield, we got to have Willie Shakespeare. Fair comment, he's all tragedy one match, comedy the next, but you have to admire his history as a playmaker. Jean-Paul Sartre's best natural position is on the left, where he can have the freedom of the park if he wants it, and Socrates, Natch, will be on Shaco's right as captain, since he more or less gave the game its name. The boy's got stamina, and if you can keep him off the hemlock, he'll go on for as long as you want. We absolutely have to find a place for King James VI and I. Never mind the dual nationality implications, he's far and away the best dribbler in the league, and I've told Pythagoras to be on the team bus in case we need to make up the numbers. The back line more or less picks itself. Genghis, Tamerlane, Attila will bite the opposition's legs all afternoon. And putting Atlas in goal, he staggers around like he's got the world on his shoulders, but he's got a good, safe pair of hands. We have to remember that this is a game of two halves, and some of these lads are not quite in the first flush, if you take my meaning. So I'm putting the Grim Reaper on the bench. If things are looking dire in the dying seconds, I'll bring him on. They'll think it's all over. It will be then.
Well done, well done, well done. So, that's some football poetry. I believe you've got a tale of the first manned flight, or attempted manned flight, by a mad monk, as you call him, of Malmesbury. Can you give us some background as to this do-daring monk?
Certainly. According to the legend, Aylmer of Malmesbury, in the 11th century, decided that flight would be possible. So he made himself some homemade wings, got up on the roof of his abbey, leapt off, and broke both his legs. So the story runs. And my poem on the subject is called Leap of Faith. You'll have prayed on the parapet, I dare say, committing your soul to the keeping of the Almighty, then tensed, taking inspiration perhaps from a swooping crow, before passing that point at which a modern co-pilot says, decision, and his captain replies, rotate. What of the journey? Such as it was, a mad monk or aviation pioneer, whichever you prefer. En route to agony, no supplication short enough comes easily to mind. Given the fact you had the balls to go out on a pennate limb in the first place, I like to think you hollered something monosyllabic in Anglo-Saxon.
And believe your listeners to understand what that might be. Influences. Which other poets do you think might have influenced you, either subconsciously or consciously over the years? Who do you admire?
I'm more interested in poems than poets, if you understand me. Hence, anthologies.
Well, poets' work. I mean, sort of works do you like? Okay. Whose sort of works?
Of course, across the board.
Auden, really. I mean, I'm thinking about the more classical, countryfied ones. The ones that get closer, the man in the street, working
but
poems.
But again, I tend, I think, to choose the poems rather than the poet. I can't think of a poet whose work I think I like all that.
Can a poet earn a living?
I would say that several poets are earning a living. Caroline Duffy, for one, the poet laureate. People like Roger McGough. And John Cooper Clarke on the performance poetry circuit comes to mind. So I would say that there's probably about 2% of them who actually make a proper living out of it. But most of them are academics like Heaney. They will write poetry and they will make money from poetry, the best of them. But obviously they're going to be trotting around doing performances in various places. I myself have never had the slightest idea making a living out of poetry.
You're listening to Terry Meekin's Roving Report, where this week we're interviewing Peter Whitten, poet extraordinaire. And to round off the programme, we're going to eavesdrop on Peter's live performance at Petersfield, where he performs Under the Stairs, Dad's Taxi Service, and Magnolia is for Officers Only.
The mat in my hall holds a mountain of envelopes, tax bills and final demands, writs and subpoenas and breath test results. So I sit with my head in my hands where it's cosy and warm and there's no one to shout. I'm under the stairs and I'm not coming out. My girlfriend appeared on the doorstep at dawn with a baby tucked under her arm. My wife, who had not met my girlfriend before, exhibited signs of alarm. I can still hear the ongoing wrestling bout, but I'm under the stairs and I'm not coming out. My son's been a criminal genius since birth. He was brought up on steroids and liquor. At his christening service, he half-inched the font and stubbed out his bag on the vicar. Now he's up in his cot with a bottle of stout, and I'm under the stairs, and I'm not coming out. There's an archangel perched on my satellite dish, the devil's defrosting the fridge. My aunt, Salman Rushdie, Lord Lucan, and Shergar are up in the loft playing bridge. A bailiff's impaled on my Rottweiler's snout, and I'm under the stairs, and I'm not coming out. Thank you very much. I have chauffeured my children from the cradle to the nave, from here to maternity. I have left no avenue unexplored within a 25-mile radius of my own front doorstep. I have lurked, engine revving, outside smash-and-grabber jelly parties, poised for a swift getaway. I have curb-crawled, petrified of being mistaken for a pervert, past scout huts and ballet classes. I have boldly burst into rave venues where wrinklies are unwelcome and gratitude rationed. I have seen in my rearview mirror backseat passion that would send Lady Gaga screaming home to her mom. Now, for the very first time, I have orders to ferry home our diuretic grandspawn. The thing... Thank you very much. There once was a sergeant and his wife and his daughter who lived in a grubby married quarter until one day a contract decorator came around with a wobbly perambulator filled to the brim with cans of emulsion and he said, now there's absolutely no compulsion, but if you wouldn't mind stepping outside for a while, I'll slap some stuff around your domicile. So the sergeant said, in his sergeant's voice, here, you're going to offer me here a little bit of choice? And the decorator said, well, of course I am. Just take your pick from the stuff in the pram. So the sergeant and his wife inspected the labels one by one, but they were quite unable to come to a decision, for their daughter, Lorna, said, what's that one in the very far corner, all on its germs, sad and lonely? And the decorator said, I'm sorry, I should have told you, that's Magnolia. And Magnolia is for officers only. I can offer you every primary colour, or if you prefer something rather duller, there's lilac, lupin, satin, silk, adorable peach or baby's milk. I mean, I can even do you British racing green. But the sergeant snapped, I'll have the one my daughter chose. And the decorator said, I've told you, that's Magnolia, and it's not for NCOs. Well, the sergeant had a total sense of humour failure. He yelled, listen, Picasso, I'm going to nail your ghoulies to the garden fence if you don't slap some of this, what's his name, on my residence. The harassed artisan, who, to give him his due, was a brave man, said, I'll never get permission. I've told you, if you want Magnolia, you'll have to take a commission. The sergeant shrieked, look, I'm just an ordinary chap. Don't want braid on me hat and all that crap. Don't want me grammar and me diction improved. I even have to have my brain removed. I'm awfully sorry, sir. Hey, dude, want to be an officer? And of course, he never did get his way. The sergeant's painter did the whole house battleship grey.
That was a roving report by Terry Meekin for Community Radio. where we've been talking to Peter Whitten, poet extraordinaire. Community Radio, daring to be different.